going to go on to the last case of the day, that being 092947 Stanley Martin versus Byron Bartow. Good morning, Mr. Netter.
Good morning, Judge Rovner, and may it please the Court. This case is about whether a person serving an indefinite term of civil commitment may seek federal habeas relief after his state petition for discharge is denied. The state of Wisconsin agrees with our principal proposition, which is that after Mr. Martin's discharge petition was denied, a new one-year clock began under AEDPA for him to challenge that denial. Nonetheless, the state contends, and the district court agreed, that Mr. Martin's petition is time-barred because he could have raised similar arguments to attack a similar earlier judgment. However, we do not see any language in AEDPA that supports that result, and therefore ask this court to reverse. There are three principal issues of dispute between the parties. First is what the text of AEDPA provides. The second is how that text should be interpreted in the context of civil commitment as opposed to a criminal sentence. And third is what Mr. Martin's habeas application and the amended petition actually provide. Now, with respect to the statute, 28 U.S.C. 2244 D1A contains one criterion. It says that the limitations period for a 2254 application can end no sooner than 1 year after the judgment becomes final. Now, the state agrees with us that the denial of discharge constitutes a judgment and started a clock. And from our standpoint, this case can be resolved by straightforwardly finding that Martin's application challenges that new judgment. It was filed within 1 year, and therefore it was premature for the district court to dismiss this action.
Can you identify for us the strongest language in the habeas petition indicating that the challenge to the use of the 1978 and 79 charges related to the denial of discharge and not solely to the commitment decision?
Sure. I would direct the court to I guess, three passages. First, in the initial application on page 86 of the record, Martin, who is proceeding pro se at the time, so we should be construing his language liberally, says that his appeal is based upon the procedures awarded under 980.09 and based on the materials that were used during his annual yearly hearing. Now, when the district court issued the show cause order asking why he wasn't only challenging the initial commitment, Martin came back, and if we look, turn to pages 103 and 105 in the record, he says that the constitutional errors are still being used against petitioner annually in annual yearly reevaluations and are being used against petitioner to continue his commitment under Chapter 980, which is inconsistent with the Eighth Circuit's holding in Revels.
Now, is that going back then to challenge the, I guess, the facts of these three incidents of the sexual abuse or whatever?
Well, I don't think that the facts are really at stake here.
What is the question that keeps coming up that goes back to the commitment time?
The question is whether the state can constitutionally rely upon its claim that these were rapes committed in 1976 and 1978, even though it entered into a plea agreement with Mr. Martin that agreed that these were not crimes of sexual violence.
Then, of course, there's lots of reasons for that. Maybe they didn't want young witnesses to testify and other things, but that is that going to be the each annual challenge that they were wrong back then? That they should have been said done something else?
No, it depends what the state does to justify his continued commitment. And what the state has done here is it has appointed a psychologist who has completed an actuarial risk assessment that says, based on the fact that Mr. Martin has committed three crimes of sexual violence, he is more likely than not to commit another crime of sexual violence.
So what is new that's going to overcome that?
Well,
don't you think you need anything new?
We don't think we need anything new. We think the new finding comes from the state, that under Fouché versus Louisiana, the state is required to demonstrate, as of the 2005 discharge proceedings, that Mr. Martin is still subject to civil detention, that it can't rely on its findings from 1996.
Is there anything that they could, I guess you say the burden's on them, but is there anything that he could come up with now that would say he's, changed or something?
Well, he certainly could. He hasn't done so in this case. But there are other available procedures in which Mr. Martin could seek to have a new psychologist appointed in his on his own behalf. But his claim here is a constitutional claim, which is that the state cannot properly use this evidence, which is built into the actuarial risk assessments, to justify his continued commitment. Now, I should add also that the merits of his ultimate claim are not strictly before the court, because the district judge issued a certificate of appealability on this important procedural question about the timeliness. And the question of the timeliness does not turn on the merits of his underlying claim.
Well, it seems that the alternative, other than him coming up with some other psychologist or psychiatrist, is to turn him loose and see what he does. That's not a very good option.
I won't speak for the state as with respect to whether or not they believe that is a viable option, but certainly from Mr. Martin's perspective, there is no valid continuing reason for him to be detained. He has been detained now since 1996, not on a criminal basis, not as punishment for past acts, but because out of concern for something he might do in the future. And now,
does he still continue to refuse the group therapy sessions?
I think the answer to that is yes, because Mr. Martin would agree to certain forms of treatment. He would agree, I think, even to the group treatment. But as a precondition to any treatment, the state would require him to admit that the 1976 and 1978 crimes involved forcible sexual relations. And given that he is not willing to make that concession, the state would then require him to go into a deniers program before he could enter into the actual treatment. So there's been this impasse about whether any treatment could go on that has lasted essentially since 1996.
A deniers program, I assume, is one that they would want to condition you to the point where you finally admit it, I guess. Is that the result of a deniers program?
Right. The idea is to make the person admit that he committed that crime and then to treat him for what happened. He is willing to go into treatment for his actual conviction for second-degree sexual assault. But the reality is that we're now dealing with a 52-year-old man and a dispute about something that did or did not happen when he was 18 and 20 years old. And at the time, the prosecutor for the state and Mr. Martin's defense attorney agreed that there were serious weaknesses with the state's arguments of forcible sexual contact, and that's my understanding as to why that was dropped. But if you go back to the psychologist's treatment of what happened in the 70s, they're just assuming that this is what happened.
You're not reinvestigating the facts or doing anything like that?
Okay. No. In fact, at the trial itself, only the psychologists testified, the 1996 commitment trial.
Of course, he did report in 98, I raped one person, and that was out of foolish anger.
Right. And he had the one conviction for second-degree sexual assault.
And that's the one you were noting then. Okay.
That's my understanding.
Assuming that there is a factual dispute between your client and the evaluators as to what these acts were, that information is subject to interpretation and determining the validity of that information by the court in terms of his reevaluation. So are you saying that that information should not simply be included because your client disputes the accuracy of calling that a rape or a sexual offense?
Well, our position is that under the Supreme Court's holdings in Mabry versus Johnson and Santabello versus New York, the state cannot constitutionally offer as undisputed fact its allegations from the criminal complaint after it entered into a plea agreement that dismissed those charges. Thus, there shouldn't be this engagement into whether or not those facts are true or not. That issue has been settled more than 30 years ago. But with respect to the issue here, on the timeliness of his petition, we believe that because it was filed within 1 year of the denial of discharge, the district court has jurisdiction and the power to entertain that dispute on the merits. I'll reserve the balance.
Sometimes in the trial courts, a matter is resolved by a plea. And let's assume the charge is armed robbery, but because of some consideration to the defendant, he pleads guilty to robbery or unlawful restraint. The facts are what the facts are, though. What the ultimate plea to, what the charge that is pled to might be certainly different than the facts. So that I would assume at the trial court on those earlier convictions, there was a factual basis that might or might not have included sexual conduct. Do you know that?
Right. There was a plea colloquy for both of those, both the no contest and the guilty pleas, in which Martin did not agree that he had committed forced sexual contact.
Sexual contact of any kind?
Well, there was sexual contact before the commission of the crimes that he stated was consensual, and the judge accepted that finding. But I would state again that the district court found here that jurists of reason could debate whether his due process rights were violated by bringing those issues in, and thus the issue before this court is the timeliness of his petition.
Ms. St. John.
Please support. This case hinges on two issues. First, does what Martin is claiming matter in terms of determining the statute of limitations? And second, if it does matter, what's Martin claiming? I have 3 points regarding each of them, and I'll start with the first. It's the respondent's position that what Martin is claiming does matter. In saying that it's irrelevant what he's claiming in determining the statute of limitations, Martin fails to do 3 things. First, he fails to provide a principled way for determining which statute of limitations applies. As he says, the respondent agrees that a new statute of limitations or clock began running with the discharge petition. But as the respondent said in his brief, there was also a clock started at the initial commitment trial, and the frequent discharge petition or proceedings that Martin has had. So there's multiple clocks running in this case, and you need a principled way to determine which clock applies in this case. Seems to the respondent that the only way you can do that is to actually look at what Martin is claiming to do that. Secondly, Martin fails to consider how 2244D1A fits in with the rest of 2244D. The rest of 2244D all talks in terms of claims, and it's impossible, as the respondent discusses in his brief, to apply that without understanding looking at the claim and determining which judgment you're looking at under 2244D1A. Third, Martin fails to consider how 2244D1A fits in with 2244B, with the prohibition on second or successive petitions. 2244D and 2244D1A are supposed to work together to prevent or to require habeas applicants to bring timely and non-repetitive petitions. If you follow Martin's position that with every discharge proceeding there's a new injury, it can be like that movie The Groundhog Day. A petitioner can keep bringing the same claim over and over and over again. They can file these discharge petitions at any time and keep raising the same basic claim.
What should he do? And what would be, if you go back to the most recent judgment, whatever we're talking about, within 1 year or a year ago, what would be appropriate? What would be an appropriate approach as opposed to what you're saying is going back to day one, Groundhog Day, I guess, and doing it all over again? What should he do if he can do anything?
Well, there's one thing that he's not claiming, which there's a couple focuses. A, he's claiming now under Fauscia that he has to be both mentally ill and dangerous to remain committed. He's not claiming that he's not those things. So he could bring a claim saying, I'm no longer dangerous and mentally ill. The focus of a discharge proceeding, which is actually what he's challenging, is whether or not he's made sufficient progress to be discharged. Now, they start with all the facts that were adduced in the factual record from the commitment trial because they need a starting point or fixed point to determine whether there's been any change. But so he could say, I've changed. You can also look at claims or examples from the O'Connor case and the Fauscia case and the Revels case that are cited in the brief. And in those cases, the focus would be, for example, on the burden of proof at a discharge proceeding or something like that involving a procedural issue involving the discharge proceeding itself. But he's not claiming anything like that. What he instead is doing is using this as a way to go back and attack what is the evidentiary record at the time of the commitment trial. At the commitment trial, the two experts, there was a Lerner and a blanking on the other person's name, but they went through a bunch of different records, and they talked to Martin, who in fact did admit, it's in docket 15, record number 4 on page 79, admitted to committing the first rape of the first conviction that was non-sexual conviction and wavered a bit on the second conviction is what the expert said in terms of admitting those rapes. So they went through all the records. They got a factual record about exactly what happened. They brought those up at the discharge proceed or at the commitment trial as a basis for their opinion about why Martin met the criteria for commitment. Martin objected to the records from those underlining convictions or those convictions coming in, but he did not object to the experts using talking about what formed the background for their opinion. And he did not appeal any of that coming in at the time of his commitment trial. He brought an appeal. He appealed things involving the experts, but he did not appeal anything about the use of these, the 1970s convictions at that time. So then they became the historical or the evidentiary record in this case. And since that time, that evidentiary record's been cited in psychological report after psychological report. In this 2005 discharge proceeding, the experts relied on psychological reports, which in turn had relied on that historical background that was created at the commitment trial, in terms of assessing whether or not he changed enough. It just provided the baseline, and the expert, Paraquette, Lori Paraquette, in the last page of her appendix talks about how she used these initial commitment, the evidence from the initial commitment and what came in then. She used it kind of as a starting point for looking at what was the focus of the commitment trial change. Now, in terms of looking at what Martin has ever actually claimed, if you go back to his 2000 discharge petition, it's on page 87 of the appendix. He really just focused on the fact that the experts at the 2005 discharge proceeding relied on the historical record from the initial commitment trial. It's in a way saying, oh, the experts looked at the transcripts from the commitment trial. Oh, the experts accepted convictions that had been ever entered as evidence in the commitment trial. He wasn't raising anything specifically new happening at the discharge proceeding like the people committed in O'Connor or Fauscia or Revels were. When you go back to his habeas application, you look at his initial application, and if you really look at that language he cited from 8009, where he has that heading, what he was really saying is, I'm using my discharge proceeding to challenge something that happened back in my commitment trial, if you read that language. It's also worth noting that that language was an introductory section. It wasn't one of the grounds he set for relief in his actual habeas application. Then when you go to his amendment...
He's pro se.
Right. But even if you're looking at his claim and giving it liberal construction and accepting the whole petition or the whole initial application as everything that he's claiming, he's really saying, if you look at his language in there, that he's challenging, he's using the discharge proceeding, and he cites Combs for the proposition that he can challenge something that happened back at the initial commitment trial. If you look at his amendment, all he says is that they relied on information. He's really just complaining that these experts, after he's been committed at a discharge proceeding, are looking back at the historical record that was created at his commitment trial.
Yeah, but because a discharge decision requires consideration of his history, both the denial of discharge and the 1996 commitment decision included some consideration of the 1978 and 79 charges. And given that overlap and the admonition that pro se pleadings are to be construed liberally, why shouldn't the district court have construed the petition as challenging the denial of discharge rather than concluding that the petition challenged solely the 1996 commitment decision? I'm so...
I think there's two reasons. One, I think if you accept... I think that, as Lori Perkett described in her appendix, there has to be a starting point for moving forward in commitment trials. And Martin suggests that finality is not important in commitment trials, but it is because of how they're used subsequently. You have an initial commitment trial, and you get an order, and that there's an evidentiary record created in that, and that forms the basis for going on and looking at whether or not there's been change, which is the focus of these discharge proceedings. Now, if you took Martin's argument, really, he could say, I didn't have effective counsel in one of my 1970 convictions, so I want to challenge that now, too. It's not, you can't rely on that anymore because there was something bad that happened with those convictions. The experts can't look at the transcripts because some evidence came in that shouldn't have at the commitment trial. They could raise all sorts of stuff like that. There were a couple of factual discussions I just want to get clear that were discussed earlier. The second degree a crime that actually formed the predicate offense was actually an attempted rape, not an actual rape, and that's on page 29 of the appendix. As I mentioned, Martin did admit to the first sexual assault, actually sexually assaulting that woman. The second one, he wavered. He said, you know, he'd hit her, or she'd hit him, so he was allowed to hit her. And he also said that she wanted to be having sex with him. I also wanted to bring up a point about the Court of Appeals in this discharge petition, in this discharge proceeding. Martin had appealed, and it had it in its decision. It said no, his commitment. It was appropriate to consider these facts at the initial commitment trial. Martin uses that as a way to say, bring up some sort of procedural default argument. I have two responses to that. First, the Court of Appeals didn't address the claim that Martin's raising now regarding his 2005 discharge proceeding. Martin has acknowledged that he did not challenge the 2005 discharge proceeding on the appeal of the denial of his discharge petition, and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, in turn, was going back and looking at the initial commitment and whether it was appropriate in that commitment. Now, the Court of Appeals decision has no bearing on timeliness. As this court has said, a state court's latitude or lassitude in timing has no bearing on the AEDPA statute of limitations. And finally, as the respondent said in its brief, the record in this case is just not developed enough to make a procedural default argument. There's two reasons. One, you need to know what claim Martin's going to be construed as making to really make a procedural default argument. Secondly, there's a lot of documents, including his appellate brief in the discharge proceeding and petition for review in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that aren't in the record right now. So the respondent would respectfully ask, firstly, for this court to affirm the district court's decision dismissing Martin's habeas application as untimely, and then in the alternative, if it didn't accept our timeliness argument, to remand the case back to the district court for further proceedings.
Mr. Martin is not trying to retry his 1996 commitment proceedings. The basis for his appeal appears quite clearly on page 843 of the appendix, which is that the psychologist appointed in 2005 went through a new analysis and did three risk assessment tools that relied upon facts that we contend could not constitutionally be part of her analysis under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. Now, aside from the fact that Mr. Martin is pro se and his petition could legitimately be read to interpret the fact that he was challenging the denial of discharge, there's also the fact that the petition was filed 15 days after the Wisconsin Supreme Court denied the petition for review. So putting together the context and the language of his petition, we contend that the most legitimate interpretation of what Mr. Martin was trying to do was to challenge this new independent finding in 2005 that he could properly be detained for another year. The one final point I would like to make is with respect to the state's argument that Martin could try to challenge past findings from the criminal cases. That leads to the core difference between criminal and civil detention. That when a court issues a criminal sentence that has imprisonment for a term of years, the state has an interest in finality. And once there's one bite at the apple in federal courts, then that decision is permanent and, except under very limited circumstances, cannot be challenged. But in the case of civil commitment, where the Supreme Court has cautioned on many occasions that this is constitutionally perilous at the outset, There should not be an interest in making findings so final that a person who does not suffer from mental illness is essentially forced to undergo a life sentence, not on the basis of crimes that he has committed, but on the basis of what he might do in the future.
The case will be taken under advisement. Mr. Netter, you were court-appointed. You have really the deep thanks of the court for the wonderful job that you have done for your client. And you too, Ms. St. John, just a terrific argument. Really, I'm sorry that, you know, everyone left and didn't want to stay. I don't understand why they wouldn't have wanted to stay, but really, thank you so much. Thank you so much.